You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 132.
On today's show, we talk about a Roman pomerium marker, a 4,000-year-old city in Iraq, and a reanalysis of skeletons from a Pleistocene-era graveyard.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. Rachel, how's the field work going?
It's going. It's going quickly. It's almost done.
By the time you hear this, it probably will be done.
One can hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Might be some cleanup.
Maybe. There's always cleanup, right?
As with all projects, there's going to be months of work after that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But less because we're recording digitally. So there you go.
True story.
All right. So we are recording outside again because we were up in our project area in Nevada and it's a little bit windy. I can hear the tent flapping around. Hopefully it doesn't rain or thunder like it did last night about this time. And we'll be good. So we also have, as we did last week, our guest co-host, Paul Zimmerman from the Archaeotech Podcast.
Yeah, also hoping that it's not going to rain because last night's rain ruined my dinner plans. And if it ruins my dinner plans again, I'll be really, really upset because this is my last good chance to grill something.
That's right.
Unless the project goes long.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. So more than likely, though, you're finishing up your first project here in the Gray Basin and headed back home in a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah. How's it been?
It's been great. It's been a good learning experience, a lot of fun. Just great to be back in the field. It's totally different than archaeology I've done before, except for survey is just generally similar, but the materials, everything is new, and that's great. It's fun to learn something new.
Well, there you go. Hopefully, if it all works out, we can have you back next year because we're going to be here at the same time.
Fingers crossed.
In the same area.
Time, same place.
That's right. So anyway, we've got three news articles that our fine producer found for us this week. And the first one is on Rome. And it was actually found in archaeonews.net. We'll have links to all these in the show notes, so I'm not going to bother spelling them. But take a look in your whatever podcast player you're using, and the notes are probably right there, and you can click on them, and most of them will just open a browser or open right there and show you the article. So don't do it while you're driving. Anyway, this one is called Ancient Rome's City Borders Were Discovered in a Rare Stone. So I had to kind of take a second look at that article. I was like, what do you mean the borders were found?
Yeah, the title is weird. It took me a second to understand what they were talking about, too.
Yeah, I mean, the basic thing here is, and we'll get into some of the dates and stuff like that, but the basic thing here is that Rome had, you know, their city limits that basically differentiated between the city limits and like the rural limits,
right?
Mm-hmm. And there was this space in between where you basically weren't allowed to be. There weren't allowed to be any weapons and stuff like that. And it was kind of like a safe zone. We'll talk about that in a little bit. I got down in my notes here. It's called the Pomerium. And they haven't found too many of these stones that actually, I guess it probably says on there, I don't know if I wrote down what it says in Latin because I can see it, but I can't read the Latin. But it basically says, you know, this is the city limit of the city of Rome. It's like those signs you see leaving town.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, this is city limits.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's like the Romans, everything is very legalese. And so they,
lots of rules, and they make sure everybody knows the rules.
Yep. Yep. So, and I guess the last one that was found was over close to 100 years ago.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. Huh. Yeah, and the cool thing is this was found on a CRM project, so it's found during excavations for a new sewage system, which I imagine in Rome, you can't drop a shovel in the ground without finding ancient Roman artifacts.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, this is from the reign of Emperor Claudius in 49 AD, so over 2,000 years ago, and it was found beneath Emperor Augustus's newly renovated tomb just off Rome's Via del Corso.
Yeah, I think the headline, the ancient borders were discovered in a rare stone. I think it's confirmed via the discovery of this stone.
You'd think they know.
Really gets the idea across a little more.
That sounds much more accurate to me because I think they knew where the borders were.
Rome's been studied
roughly.
Yeah, and if they found more of these, which it says they have, it says 10 other stones of this kind have been found. Now, Rome is a big city even back then.
Yeah.
But, and with only 10 found, even if you, I mean, if you know where all those were, presumably they were found I don't know. I guess you don't need to presume this, but presumably they were found where they were placed or close to it. So mm-hmm. you could kind of infer with those 10 points what the boundaries at that time would have mm-hmm. been. Mm-hmm. Because maybe that was well documented, but you know, maybe we haven't found that yet, or maybe it burned up and, you know, or something like that. So I don't really know.
Well, I imagine it's not like a perfect circle or oval sure. or whatever. Yeah. So finding these stones will help you get the like minute details and map and shape mm-hmm. of the original, you know, city limits, I suppose. Yeah. But yeah. that's just a guess because I don't really know much about it.
Correlated to other topographic, geographic features, yeah. Yeah. other architecture and so on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure paintings and stuff. And there's a wall too. You know, the whole city was walled.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
you know, that there should be evidence of that at the same time.
So I'm kind of curious how these were. I read up a little bit on Pomeria after this mm-hmm. to try to get a sense of it because I thought that the city wall defined the city, mm-hmm. and it sounds like these stones define the city, but the name of the Pomeria is a corruption of along the wall.
Okay.
So I'm wondering what these yeah. stones are doing that the wall isn't.
Yeah.
Maybe this is just what they, you know, the wall is one thing, but then they've got somebody, there's no real indication how big this is. I guess it actually is pretty big. It's sitting, yeah. I think, behind the mayor of Rome in one of the pictures.
Yeah. But yeah, it looks like it's over a meter long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty good size.
Probably wasn't super light, but they had plenty of slaves to move it for them. So it's possible that they were like scratching this out, you know, pecking it away and etching the words into it independent of the wall. You know, the wall's being built. I mean, I'm thinking, why don't they just, like, peck this into the wall? But maybe they, I mean, they're Rome. They have to be special. So maybe it was a separate, like, pillar that was, you know.
Yeah, I mean, from what I gather, it's a separate monument, kind of yeah. like a mile mm-hmm. marker, which is something that we know about, you know, much mm-hmm. more commonly from, well, we, meaning somebody like me who doesn't know a whole hell of a lot about classical archaeology.
Right, right.
But I do know about mile markers. And yeah. the Pomeria seem to be the same sort of thing. It's a marker, but I'm wondering how it correlates, how tightly it correlates, where it's placed in relationship to that wall.
Yeah, what was the standard measurement between markers? How often did they want to have, you know, how far were they spaced, things like that.
Yeah, and was the whole point to just warn people of the fact that they were entering space that was controlled by Rome, essentially? Is that...
Yeah, well, it's not just controlled by Rome, but special legal status
okay.
space
okay.
that's differentiated from other spaces that are also controlled by Rome.
Yeah, because Rome controlled a lot of space.
Yeah, and so, even yeah. within their city, there's the city proper, which is inside uh-huh. this pomerium, and then there's other parts of the city that are important, but because of the rules, they have to be carved off differently mm-hmm. in terms of, like, who can enter it, what status they have when they enter it, mm-hmm. whether they can have weapons. That would seem to be a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it says it was a religious, like the Pomerium was a religious, military, and political boundary defining mm-hmm. the limit of the city. So from a tax standpoint, from a, mm. you know, who's your politician standpoint, you know, all those kinds of things.
Right.
This would have defined that limit. You yeah. know, you're outside the city officially right here in Rome, of all places, would have wanted you to know exactly when you're outside the city, because I'm sure that if you like broke some law or infraction, it really mattered where you were.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They're no different than we are really today.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, most of our modern, you know, politics and economics and civil structures based on Roman
to some mm-hmm. extent. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. So at least based on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The reason why I dove into the Pomeria a little bit, even though I'm still very hazy on what they were specifically, is mm-hmm. prohibition against weapons inside it reminded me something that I've seen in Arabia, especially in South Arabia. You have these towns. They're usually market centers. Sometimes they're religious centers, mm-hmm. but they're hautas. They're special places. Tribal grievances, weapons, so on, are all left outside
yeah.
so that people can conduct business, mm-hmm. religious matters, whatever, within it without the fear of violence. Mm-hmm. So it's a city, but it's a city with its own special rules. And so it reminded me of that. I don't think it's the same thing, but, it's similar. And I'm sure there's a similar thing in plenty of other cultures as well.
Yeah, we do this today, but a lot of big city-state areas have used religion in a number of ways, mm-hmm. right? And this says it's a consecrated piece of land along the city walls, and like you said, no weapons, but also no farming, you can't live there, no building. It's basically just an open piece of land that surrounds the city. Now, this could have been seen as like a, you know, some sort of, I don't know, religious even buffer that is, like they said, consecrated land. People don't want to go in there. And they could have used that in religious terms to keep the fear in people, but really, it was probably, you know, a good military boundary, mm-hmm. you know, so yeah. people can't just march up to your walls and, well, they can, but they're making a statement when they do that.
Well, more importantly, they can't, like, store a bunch of arms right outside the walls.
Yeah.
Well, they're not supposed to. I'm sure they could do it in secret if they could find a way, but the idea is you can't have a whole storage of a bunch of things that could
yeah.
you could attack the city with or whatever.
And you're not going to build a house right up against the wall and tunnel underneath.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have to tunnel from further away.
The protection factor kind of makes sense when you think about totally. It like that.
Yeah, I'm sure it's multiple reasons why these existed.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a moat, right? Like from medieval times.
It's a legal moat.
Yeah, but the Romans were strong enough that they didn't have to build a moat. To keep people out, they could just put up a really imposing piece of stone that says, don't come in here.
I'm sure for every one of these, there were 100 Roman soldiers standing right next to it.
Well, possible.
At all times.
Possible.
Yeah.
I think they had a pretty good hold on their population. But
Yeah, again, I said it. There's only been 10 others found of this kind. But if I feel like if we had more knowledge of the city limits of Rome at that time, and I say at that time because, I mean, as those fluctuated and changed, are there rings of these as Rome got bigger and then, you know, coming in as Rome, you know, contracted a bit over the years?
Oh, I don't know. Romans were pretty smart. They probably just picked it up and moved it.
Maybe.
If they needed to. Like, why waste the effort of creating a whole new one?
Yeah, and if there was one out there, that would be a different legal boundary and there could be confusion, too. So maybe they did move them.
Yeah.
But, no idea.
Yeah. Anyway, it would have been cool to see. I don't know if anybody's thoroughly studied this or if they've just been found accidentally, but it seems like with enough knowledge of the past and, you know, Rome at that time, you could probably kind of find the rest if you wanted
to. Yeah, probably.
If they haven't been dug up and they're sitting
somewhere
else.
Well, it sounds like the rest of Rome has grown up around these things.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like modern Rome.
Way bigger now.
Yeah. So like the chances of finding them intact.
They're under parking lots.
Exactly. Like they might be there, but.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, every Roman citizen listening to this, just go down into your basement, dig around a little bit, see what you find.
Yeah,
talk to my aunt, my cousins.
There you go.
Wait, weren't you just reading an article about somebody who found like a bath under their house?
Yeah, it was like a 2,000-year-old like steps leading down to like this Roman bath.
Yeah,
not Roman. It was, but it was like a bath area.
Yeah,
there's a picture of it in the. if you're listening to this in real time, it is in the. Newsletter that released from the APN on Friday,
which is really cool. I would love to live in a city old enough that you could just like be doing some construction on your house, some remodeling, and like, you know, find an ancient bath under there. NBD.
I know. I'm a little sad that if we do any renovations to our RV, the only thing we could potentially find is like a note from some sad RV construction guy that left it in the walls saying, right. I don't want to work here anymore.
You can find mouse poop.
And that.
Definitely.
Probably
definitely
a colony of ants.
Definitely those.
Lots of vermin.
Yeah. We're like a traveling ecosystem, really. It's kind of gross.
Yeah. Let's not think about that too hard.
Right. Wow.
So,
that went downhill real fast.
That did go downhill real fast. So, all right. Well, that was a 2,000-year-old marker in Rome. Let's double that and head to Iraq. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 132. And we are moving down to Iraq. And this one is pretty cool. The site was found by a group of Russian archaeologists, and it's actually the article that our producer found is from AlMonitor.com.
Yeah.
So
AlMonitor is an American-based, I think, Middle Eastern news magazine.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I think it's all online now. I don't know if they have a paper version. That said, this article seemed like it was a translation of about a bunch of different ones.
Yeah.
It was a little confused.
Yeah,
there was definitely some language issues in here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the picture on the front, too, it's a little misleading.
Very misleading.
Very misleading. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just found, they did a Google image search and said, well, this was mentioned. Let's put that up there.
Yes. And so what they show on the image here is the Great Ziggurat from the site of Ur,
right?
Which is a site near the one that was discovered that they discuss in the article.
Yeah.
But not the same one.
Okay. I was confused about how those were related.
Yeah, they mentioned a lot of sites that are aren't the site that they're talking about. And they mentioned a lot of time periods that aren't the time period they're talking about.
Oh. We're just like name dropping the whole thing.
Exactly. That's what's happening.
I feel like we just need to change this podcast to like critique of media.
That's kind of what we do, though.
That is kind of what we do, because they just do not do a good job sometimes.
Before we get too critical, though, one thing that I really did like about this, and this shows the way that this news organization approaches their collection of the news, they spoke to a lot of Iraqi archaeologists that are quoted in here.
Yeah.
And so that's a very good thing in my book.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, this was just, according to the article, this came out July 9th, but it was discovered June 24th. So pretty fresh information.
That's brand new.
Which is probably why, I mean, they said discovered June 24th, not that's when they read the paper. Mm-hmm. So there probably hasn't been a paper, and there won't be one for 6 months to a year.
Yeah, it didn't seem like there was a paper out yet. It looks like this was a news press release.
Yep.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it includes a video, which basically shows, again, a bunch of pictures and things like that, and repeats a lot of stuff from the article, but it gives you a nice idea of what the article says if you don't have time to read it. But anyway, Russian archaeological team, this is a 4,000-year-old sediment, and Paul, you might have to help with the pronunciation if you can, but found in the, how does that pronounce,
Digar.
And governorate. I'd never even heard that term before.
A lot of countries in the Middle East are divided into governorates. They're basically like states are in the U.S. or counties are within a state.
Okay.
It's provinces within the...
Got it.
Gotcha. Found an area called Tell al-Duhala, where more than 1,200 archaeological sites are, including, as the only picture on the top that they have here is, the Great Ziggurat of Ur.
Yeah, okay. So Tell al-Duhala would be a different site that is not...
not where this site
is. This is
where the confusion
Ur,
came in.
Just Tell al-Muqayyir. Yeah.
Now, they said the area called Tell...
I think that's a mistranslation.
Is it really?
Confusion by the writer.
I was wondering about that. Because a tell is a hill, right?
Yeah. It's a man-made hill.
Right. Okay. Anyway, so let's see what... I'm just going to keep reading some of the quotes I brought out of here, and we'll have Paul shoot them down and tell us what they really mean. So...
this is perfect.
So the city that they found was an urban settlement located on the banks of a water course and could have been the capital of a state founded following the political collapse at the end of the Babylonian era in the middle of the second millennium BC. That sounds like a lot of, it sounds like a lot that they found and a lot of determination and stuff from something that was found 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they think it's the capital, maybe by the size of the site.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know about the distribution of sites from this time period. The Babylonian era, there are a couple of Babylonian, but this is talking about the old Babylonian. And so you would know of Hammurabi, the Codex Hammurabi.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He lived about 1800 BCE.
Okay.
Okay. So this would be at the end of the period that he was one of the kings of. Mm. And so that would put us squarely in the middle of the second millennium BCE.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, it's real interesting. I mean, they're calling this a city.
Yeah.
Like, they found a city. And one of the other cool things, let me jump down to where this is. Discovery introduces the world to one of the Sumerian cities overlooking the seaports. Most cities used to have a view of the seaport above the sea, but have turned today into a vast desert because they're further inland now.
Right.
And that's happened. But I'm wondering, man... I mean, how many cities over there are left to remain discovered? They said a city, indicating many buildings, you know, maybe a wall, stuff like that. Like, what actually did they discover, I wonder? And how is this a new discovery?
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen maps.
Yeah.
To know exactly where the site was and to see what exactly it looked like.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me wonder, too, because white archaeologists, and I'm going to go ahead and group the Russians into that category, show up to an area and be like, look what we discovered.
Yeah.
But the locals, the people who live there on that land, have known it was there all along.
Right.
It's just that when it's part of your landscape, you don't necessarily think of it as something to study or something
now,
to learn about.
Within the Iraqi context, part of what discovery means isn't that, hey, look, here's this tell we didn't know about.
Uh-huh.
Everybody knew that there was a tell there.
Right.
Hey, we dug into it.
Yeah.
And we start to know what ancient city it was that we had not previously identified.
Which makes sense.
Right.
So it's
got a slightly different take on discovery. And that's, again, that's why I'm pleased that they had so many Iraqi archaeologists quoted in this.
Yeah.
Because it lends credence into it, not just being, like you were saying, white Europeans going, hey, look what we found, to a project that's involving a bunch of different people saying, we knew there was something here. What we found is specifically, or more specifically, what it is.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
it's a site dating to this time period. It's a very large site. Therefore, we think that it's an important site. Therefore, we think it might be the capital city of... Still not sure which kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't even mentioned a name yet.
No.
That they found anything indicating what it is.
It must be too early to truly have, like, dates or anything,
they
right?
They have writing. They expect to find cuneiform documents in an undisturbed context, they say.
Yeah.
They can read that.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, so
by that time period, fairly easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine. You know, again, I'm going back to what was discovered, and I just can't imagine the monumental... You know, we get happy when we'd, you know, we're excited when we find a 100 phlegolithic scatter. Like, look what we found. It's enormous. But not only did these guys find an entire city, but it says they also discovered an ancient port and remains of a temple wall 4 meters wide.
Right.
I thought it was interesting to mention in the same sentence the temple wall that was 4 meters wide, because if you found an entire city in a port, that seems like you're kind of burying the lead a little bit. Like, like what did you find that indicates this is a city and a port if you're mentioning a single wall?
Right.
Well, yeah, but a 4 meter wide wall, that's heavy duty right there.
Yeah, but if you found a city in a port, you probably found 400 other 1 meter wide walls. That seems like more important to me, you know?
For determining what the city is, finding a monumental building like that with 4 meter wide walls, that tells you that this is an important center.
Right.
And that's probably what they're basing the idea that this might be a capital city.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I will say that every major capital city has temples that have big honking mud brick walls.
Right.
Yeah. I would imagine a lot of cities of almost any size probably have big temples. I mean, it was kind of a big focus.
Yeah, yeah. And most of the cities, I mean, by Hammurabi's time, it's not all broken up into city-states.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this very, like, city focus, even through there, where the cities are semi-independent.
Mm.
Right? They have their own gods, their own religious structures. They administer the temple. The temple administers a lot of the lands. You know, by this time period, there are legitimate kingdoms, definitely, that span multiple cities, but there also are empires.
Right.
You know, we've already gone through the Akkadian Empire.
Mm.
That happened 500 years prior to Hammurabi.
Okay. Right.
Well, another interesting thing that was pulled out of this article is, well, first off, this area is commonly known as the cradle of civilization because archaeology was invented here.
Yes, it was.
It may well have been. They had cities 12,000 years ago, so I'm sure 8,000 years ago they were studying going, what is this?
Like, the ancestor of the first archaeologist is definitely from there. So.
Absolutely. You have Assyrian and Babylonian kings who are excavating.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Ancient sites to show that they rebuilt the temple on the exact plan of the same temple that was there 2,000 years prior, because they know about it, because they have the documents.
Yeah.
So,
So while I wasn't wrong, what I meant to say was the article also mentions that the first development of agriculture using silt in Mesopotamia. Now, they didn't say the first development of agriculture using silt anywhere, they said using silt in Mesopotamia, was also discovered. It says that the site contains remains of the material from the period that preceded the emergence of the Sumerian civilization.
Right. And so this is one of the points where this article is a little confusing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So definitely. What they're talking about is 4,000, 5,000 BCE. So well earlier than this site.
Yeah.
You know, and I totally believe that they have things there, because some of the earliest Sumerian sites and pre-Sumerian sites are in the same province, right, in the same governorate. So like Ubaid, which gives its name to the Ubaid period, which is the first, I suspect they're probably proto-Sumerians, but that's where we start to see the gelling of all the different features that we associate with high Sumerian culture.
Gotcha.
So that's in the same area. So I'm not at all surprised they found that, but I don't know how those...
Like, how are they related?
Exactly.
Spatially.
How do those waterworks relate spatially?
And
I know temporally because I know this.
Yeah.
This is material I'm studying. But they don't explain that in the article.
Yeah.
And certainly they don't tell us what how they relate
that's
spatially.
That's probably one of the downsides of writing a big article like this, where they clearly had a press release and maybe talked to a handful of archaeologists and got, like, this bit of information and that bit of information, and then just sort of, like, cobbled it all together.
Yeah, 100%. I'm sure that's what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like most archaeological digs, you don't find just like the one thing that you're looking for. Like you said, this evidence, you know, predates the city that they found. But also, they mentioned some other things they found from different time periods. They found oxidized arrowheads, traces of tandoor stoves, and clay camel statues dating to the early Iron Age. So lots of different things found on this site, which you would expect of this area that's been inhabited for many tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, like lumping all that together, it's like, well, how do you split these out by age and group of people? And it's just, again, it's just like a conglomeration of a bunch of information, but not specifics on any one bit of it.
Yeah, I'd really love to see the development of the site stratigraphy in this. You know, look at the paper and see how they excavated. Did they do a few test units that were, you know, several meters deep? Did they, you know, what did they do? So
I suspect, from what I know about Mesopotamian archaeology, what they did is they had a survey of the region, and that's what they're reporting, all this wide variability from
that makes sense.
You know, from 5000 BCE right up until, you know, I don't know, Iron Age, so it could be the first, it could be even like as late as the first century BC.
Sure.
That would explain this wide range of stuff and time period and everything.
And then they did excavations on the tell, and that's what they're focusing on. Mm-hmm. But the way the article's written, they're telling us everything.
Mm. Yeah. All right. Well, any other thoughts on this site?
Cool. I mean,
yeah, very neat.
I have a friend that's working at another site in the area, and also found honkin' big temple.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of interesting work. He's in Iraqi, and so there's a lot of interesting work that's going on there. And again, say it the third time, I'm very pleased that Iraqis themselves are being so closely involved in the work in their own country.
Yep.
Well, and I'm glad we're talking about an article like this, because honestly, to me, and I'm sure most Americans, Iraq, because of the media and what's happened there, always seems like a pretty unstable place. And I'm, you know, initially I shouldn't have been, but I was shocked that people outside of Iraq were even doing archaeology there. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know that they were even getting permits for that, allowing people in, doing that kind of thing, because it always seems so unstable.
Right. Most American projects in Iraq now are happening in the north, in Iraqi Kurdistan.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
In the deep south, there have been a couple American projects, and there have been, I think, Italian. I've forgotten who all is working. Probably a French or German project, maybe Dutch.
Are they
also
Russians?
Russians.
Are they required to work with local people? Because from my time in Peru, like, we were required to work with local Peruvian archaeologists.
Yeah,
so
they are.
Good. That's really good to get the local.
It is. It's just what happens when it comes to publication and dissemination of information.
Yeah.
It tends to be the European and American archeologists that get the credit.
Yeah.
And such.
Yeah.
Was it Russia that was down there, or the Russian Archaeological Committee? Is it too soon? That's an Olympics joke. Sorry, Russia.
I mean, didn't that happen like 4 years ago now?
But they're
longer,
calling themselves
maybe?
The ROC now.
Well,
so.
They still are, because they're still in trouble.
Oh, boy.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry, Russians.
All right.
So we are going to keep traveling back in time to 13,000 years ago. We're going to do that on the other side of the break. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 132, and as promised, we are 13,000 years into the past, so further than before. We're just keep marching back in time with this episode today.
Perfect.
This one is one of those articles that, I guess, you know, archaeologists like to say stuff, and then it gets refuted like decades later or something like that, when more information is found or someone actually studies it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of those things. And it kind of, for people not in the know, I feel like it would kind of throw into question everything we know. Because if you read it in a textbook, you tend to believe it. If you know, see it in a paper, you tend to believe it. But it's only true until something else comes along to either disprove it or more prove it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you got to kind of look at all the articles that support something and all the evidence that supports something.
Yeah, that's why scientifically speaking, it's really hard to create a law, right? Most things are theories.
Right.
Most everything is a theory because you can't be 100% all the time.
Right.
And it's the same with archaeology.
Well, this one, as I click away from the ad I tried to get away from. Oh, that's just going to keep on.
Yeah, there's a lot of ads in this article.
Yeah, there's a lot of
like
ads.
Like, a lot of ads.
Warning, it goes to this article that we've got linked is from the Daily Mail,
yes,
which is notoriously bad British tabloid.
Yeah.
So if I had hair, and I'm an absolute cue ball, it would have all been standing up on end when I first saw it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't actually bad.
No.
I said the same thing. But to their credit, they link to a Nature article.
Yeah.
in Nature's Scientific Reports, and you can download the whole PDF.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's all open source. So if you want to, it's a pretty decent summary of the article here, which is why we're going to go ahead and link to this Daily Mail article. Mm-hmm. So, but you're right. I normally wouldn't even consider
it. Put the other one in the link to, in the
Both be in there. Yeah, they'll both be in there. You'll be able to see the Daily Mail one and then the Nature Reports article, or Scientific Reports, sorry. The Scientific Reports one, if you want to search for it, is called New Insights on Interpersonal Violence in the Late Pleistocene, based on the Nile Valley Cemetery of Jebel Sahaba. Mm-hmm. And anyway, the thing that we're talking about here, again, this is 13,000 years old. The site was discovered in 19, or excavated, I should say, discovered. It was a cemetery discovered in 1965 on the east bank of the Nile, containing at least 61 individuals dating back to about 11,000 BCE. And half of them died from inflicted wounds, or so they could tell from that. Mm-hmm. The people of the time, the scientists of the time,
The 1960s time. Yeah.
Now, the article says, you know, evidence of the first race war was actually something else. They never actually said race war in the article. They said, what did they say? Originally thought to be the earliest known example of communal violence between groups.
Right.
And I'm, again, not sure how they thought that. We'd have to read the original article.
Yeah, going from communal violence between groups to race war.
Yeah, why that's, would that like, be racist? That's a leap.
Given that it was the Daily Mail, that's why I just oh, this is going to be a slog.
Yeah.
Well, and we all know. Turned out really interesting instead, though.
Yeah.
We all know that you can't determine race from skeletal remains anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a social construct anyhow.
Yeah, totally.
Although in the 60s, they probably thought they still could, right? So if they're making judgments back, the 1960s judgments, maybe.
But it would presume that you'd have an analogous cemetery of...
Of the other side,
the
right?
Other side,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
Yeah, that is a good point, because they only mentioned like the one cemetery that they're discussing here. So, anyway, so this was what they called an ancient battleground in Sudan, again thought to be the first race war. Not quite true.
No.
But what it turns out, and this is really cool from a reanalysis of the skeletal evidence, it looks like this was actually just a series of conflicts, maybe close in time because they're all buried in the same cemetery, and they're all buried right there. But the way they can tell that is they looked at the healed trauma on some of those. Now, if this were all happened at once and it was one huge battle, nothing would have healed, right? They would have just died, and then the process kind of stops right there.
Right. Bones heal. So you get stabbed, you get chopped, whatever.
Yeah.
The bone will heal around it. You break a leg, whatever.
Yeah.
And they can see that osteologically. And that's what the reanalysis did. It looked very closely using new tools at the skeletons that were recovered from this.
Exactly.
One thing I don't remember noticing was, did they talk about the breakdown of sex? Was it more men, more women?
I didn't even see that mentioned.
Children?
You know, I read the intro conclusion and I skimmed the rest of the the actual article. And I don't recall that. There were children as young as four. I remember that stood out.
It would be interesting to know, because if this is such a violent interaction that caused a lot of these deaths, it would be interested to know the makeup of the victims.
Yeah, and that's race war is not the right term, but if it was attempting to wipe out an entire opposing community, you would expect you'd find equal numbers of men, women, old, young.
Yep. But if it was
board.
A battle, if it was ongoing battles that were happening continuously, then I would think you would see the warriors, more men, given... Well, but that depends on the makeup of the society and who the warriors were.
Also, it depends
on
the lethality of the tools they're using, the weapons they're using.
Yeah, right. True.
The reanalysis identified 106 previously undocumented lesions and traumas, and they were able to distinguish between projectile point injuries from arrows and spears, from trauma related to close combat.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, I imagine close combat trauma is a lot more slashing and crushing.
Yep.
Whereas spears and projectile points are going to be a lot more just like
puncturing.
Going through your skull. Yeah, punctury.
Yeah. Punctury. That's a word.
Yeah, a lot more punctury.
Yeah.
But that is one cool thing. They said at least half of the wounds were identified as puncture wounds caused by projectiles like arrows or spears, which they say supports the theory that the attacks happened from a distance.
Yeah, it makes it sound like people are being sniped at.
Yeah, right. Yeah, totally.
But
does.
You know, I know this isn't a good source of historical data, but like every movie you see, you know, and every video
it's not
game.
A good source
every
at all.
Every movie I like, see listen, is a good source of historical data. Right?
In Braveheart.
Listen, in Braveheart, that's not how they did it. But, no, but this would make sense. If they did have bow and arrow technology, everybody knows that, you know, if you have a bow and arrow or you have spears, you know that has to have a longer range than your sword or your club or whatever you have, right? So you are going to necessarily put those people behind. I mean, that's a common, you know, soldiering.
Like military tactic.
Military tactic, yeah. Is you're going to put those people in back because, you know, they have to travel lighter. They can't have all this armor and stuff on while they're trying to wield a bow. So they're going to be in the back, and they are going to, you know, they're going to take some people out before they even get, and that's their whole point. They're going to take some people out before the lines converge.
Yeah.
So if it was that kind of a battle, which I don't know there's any way we can tell that. All we have is a cemetery. We don't even have a battleground.
Right.
Or the other side, presumably. So... yeah, it's hard to say. I think we'd have to know a lot more about how far apart these people were in death. You know what I mean? Like, were they did they all die at the same time? They didn't. They said that clearly.
Yeah, they're saying 13,000 years ago, but was it 13,000 years and 100 years? Or
well,
was it 12,000?
Radiocarbon dates going
do they?
Back to 18,000 BP.
Oh.
So,
yeah, who knows?
That's a big range,
right? That's a huge
right?
range, so, but you wouldn't... probably be burying in a cemetery like this for 5,000 years, 61 people.
That's
that
seems a, like a lot.
Yes.
That seems like
and to
a
even
lot of time.
Relate those people and together like that.
So
that
I'm willing
time.
To believe that they're from basically
same time period.
They're basically contemporaries.
Yeah.
But that's conjecture on my part.
Another thing I thought I didn't read the I skimmed like the abstract and some stuff from the original article, but they also say that. You know, while they found that this is probably a succession of violent episodes rather than one, they said probably exacerbated by climate change. What
that
is going on with
thing.
That comment?
Well, I mean, is climate change causing their hunting prospects to be less, or are they competing over resources basically because
of
climate change?
Right. So my first reaction to that was that it was also, there are a lot of archaeologists that because of the current milieu and because we're, you know, probably experiencing, you know, epic defining climate change right now.
Right.
That are interpreting a lot of old conflict in terms of climate change. And so I generally roll my eyes at that.
Yeah.
Though I'm definitely a believer in anthropogenic climate change right now, projected into the past as an explanation, I usually roll my eyes because I'm thinking, you just latch onto something that's trendy. And that was my first reaction to this. But when I was reading the article, I'm like, okay, I see what they're doing. They're trying to narrow it into what's happening globally in the climate. And I don't know how specifically they get to this area, but they build an argument that makes a little bit of sense.
They say in general that the end of the Ice Age was causing essentially an environmental disaster because the Earth wasn't prepared for it. You know, it had been in an Ice Age for too long, which caused the attackers and the victims, presumably they weren't both attackers. They could have been.
They could have been, though. You don't know.
Know.
Like, it could have been two families that lived in the same area.
The Hatfields and the McCoys.
Totally.
Montagues and the Capulets,
exactly.
So they were
then they would have had a lot of stabbing.
Yeah, a lot of stabbing.
A lot of stabby there. But they said they caused them to live together in a smaller area.
Right.
Now, okay, I might believe that if you're talking about, like, you know, southern France or something like that. But I don't know how much the, you know, like the Sudan or the Sahara Desert was affected by global climate change in the end of the Pleistocene. I really don't know. And... yeah. Unlike the anthropogenic climate change that we're experiencing now, we're experiencing climate change in a way that is so rapid and fast that we can actually see it.
Right.
But back then, we're talking, you know, climactic and geological timescales where if they were experiencing climate change, they wouldn't have known it. They probably wouldn't have known anything was different about the world from the time they were born to the time they were dead. But if you go back maybe five generations, there might be a difference. Maybe 10, I don't know, but in one generation with a bunch of people, I don't know if they would have known that.
Well, which gets again to the question, how disparate in time are these bodies in this burial, in this graveyard?
So given that this was all found in one cemetery, kind of tells me, I mean, 13,000 years ago, I mean, I know we had, you know, pretty well-established civilizations, not quite city-states, but getting pretty darn close 13,000 years ago. And was that years ago or BC? No, 30 years ago. So,
years, yeah.
11,000 BC. So we're getting pretty close to, you know, getting some pretty well-established societies. But what did their cemeteries look like? You know, how did they bury their people? If you've got only 65 people, tells me that that could have been a series, not to quote another movie, a series of unfortunate events. But, you know, because if it were hundreds of people or thousands of people, that might be like a city's cemetery.
Mm-hmm. Well, this to the best of my knowledge, any permanent settlements.
Yeah.
I mean, this is earlier than things like Göbekli Tepe.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it was saying
permanent
settlement. Yeah. Yeah. No, I was just going to say that previously they only had like two or three individuals buried together. So that's why this was so special and different, is the number of individuals.
Yeah. Right.
So that minimum number of individuals, right?
The
like
other
there could
really
be
interesting
more.
The question here is why so many people buried in one spot.
Yeah. You know? Which I understand why in the 60s they would have assumed it was more of a mass death situation to have that many people from so long ago in one area.
Yeah. And even if it's within a generation or two, it implies that this is a spot that's frequented by people.
Yeah.
And frequented
for sure.
by people who are getting, you know, shot with arrows a lot.
Yeah.
And often just before they die.
Yeah.
So then they get buried right there.
Yeah.
Which makes me think that, hey, don't go by the cemetery. You'll get shot.
Yeah, I'm not going over there. Everyone over there is dead.
Duh.
Definitely not going near there.
Definitely not. So the interesting thing about this article for me is it really might show how archaeologists are so influenced by their current situation, right? Their current circumstances. Because the way I interpreted this was in 1965, when this was discovered, they called it the first race war. What was happening in 1965?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Civil rights.
Good point.
Right?
Yeah.
Civil rights movement. So, like, that was happening, and then they call it the first race war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we're reanalyzing. We're also in the middle of the biggest, like, acknowledged climate crisis that the world has seen, that we know of. And what do they call it?
That
we caused. Yes. And what are they saying? That it was influenced by climate change. So I wonder if in another 20, 40, 50 years, what archaeologists are going to look at this and interpret. And I feel that way about basically every archaeological site and everything, because we're always informed by what is happening currently for our culture and for us.
That's a good point.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to take this up, and in 30 years, I'm going to call it the first Republican debacle that that we can identify. So
bold of you both to think that there are going to be people around in 30 or 50 years.
True.
Oh, we got a Debbie Downer over here.
Hey, I don't know where you're going to be, but I'm going to be, you know,
well, 50
out.
Years from now. I'm pretty sure I'll be in the cemetery.
No, you'll be in my iPad, and I'll be in my RV. You know, we'll be.
Oh,
in the
I
RV.
Thought you were going to say cryogenically frozen somewhere. Probably.
Well, I mean, I'm 50 in 4 years. And I've always said, for probably 30 years that I'm going to be cryogenically frozen at 50 and shot into space. And that's actually getting closer to a possibility with, you know, the billionaires making that happen.
Yeah.
So,
I'm gonna see if definitely going to happen.
I'm sure Bezos is going to let me buy on Amazon, like cryogenically freezing my head and putting it up on the penis rocket. So
that you can come back in like 50 or 100 years and reinterpret.
Like 3,000 years.
And tell everybody how wrong their interpretations of our like current
I'm not coming back until another like species can awaken me. So that's going to be the note on my device.
Big words over
back
here.
Back to your misanthropy from last session. Huh?
That's right.
Oh man.
All right. Well, again, thanks to our producer for finding these. If there's anything you find and you want us to talk about it and put an archaeological lens on an article, then feel free to send it over chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Or you can comment just about anywhere where you find this, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, or wherever it happens to be.
Or if you get the email, you can always just, like the APN newsletter, you can just reply to it. Just reply to it, and that comes right back to us, too.
Yeah, and if you want to get the APN newsletter, you can head over to our website. And if you haven't been there in a while, archpodnet.com. Just scroll up a little bit, and this annoying pop-up box shows up. Just put your email address in there, and then hit OK, and don't worry about it. So that's how you do that. So, again, thanks a lot. Thanks, Paul, for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me again. A lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And if you want to hear a couple live episodes of the Archaeotech podcast, then head over to the Archaeotech podcast and listen to Paul and I talk in the field about different things. And in fact, our next one, we have a guest, and that's going to be interesting because Paul and I both have garbage internet. So that should be real fun.
Yeah, Archaeotech on garbage internet.
Oh my goodness. I forgot about that.
Okay, so. Should be great.
All right. We'll see everybody next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to come in and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.